Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined by our friend Alex Lawson, who's the Executive Director of Social Security Works.
He also happens to own WEACT Radio. How funny! Isn't that interesting that we would know him?
Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, we always love having you on.
And I always love being on.
We have missed you dearly.
It's been too long, I think.
Let's not let it go this long again.
We have to regularly make fun of the liars on Wall Street. I'm sorry. The greedy liars on Wall Street who want to steal all of our money. So we shouldn't let it go this long without making fun of them.
And things happen in the world that are cruel and stupid, which is your test for excellent public policy.
So exactly.
We should be having you on more. So Tracy, why are we having Alex on this week?
Well, there's a couple of big things that we have on for him to talk about. Actually, I love these episodes because we're always discussing Social Security, which you two are experts on, and I'm just here so I don't get fined. So, but I get to learn a lot in these sessions. But we have them on to talk about the budget deal that happened, and also Elizabeth Warren's Social Security legislation. Let's start with that.
We've
budget
got a
deal.
Good set of things, but mm-hmm. You kind of spoiled what our number of the week is going to be.
Oh, I did. Well, you know what? We'll still do it anyway. Whoops.
All right. Without the suspense for Alex. So, Alex, we actually haven't had an episode in a couple of weeks for various reasons, in part because Tracy has been a globetrotter.
That's true.
And we haven't had a chance to talk about the budget deal that the White House negotiated and that was passed through the House and passed through the Senate and actually was signed into law. And that budget deal was really important for Social Security because it included a provision to prevent those across-the-board benefit cuts that we were all really worried about Republicans effectively forcing through for disability insurance. Tell us a little bit about this really good news.
So the way I look at it is it's not a victory, but what it is a huge opportunity. And the reason it's not a victory is because primarily what it is we prevented terrible things from happening.
And unnecessary. Should never have been out there on the table in the first place.
The Republicans were literally holding a 20% benefit cut over millions of people's heads in order to force through ideologically driven cuts and dismantling of the entire Social Security system. And we were looking at that in the lame duck of next year. And you know, and I know, because we've been going around the hill, all of the discussions that were being had on this, everything that they were saying they were willing to, quote unquote, take in order to not do this were horrible. They were cruel and stupid. And they were some of the top, you know, the worst things that you could design for Social Security. They were all designed to weaken the system. But instead, none of that happened. It was not a full victory because a full victory is a Congress that does its job, that reallocates, which is the regular, you know, the very orderly thing that happens with the two Social Security trust funds that operate as one. There's only one system. Actuarially, there's only one system. But Congress refused to do their job, which they've been doing for, you know, at least 6 years now. It's a really interesting one. You should jump in because there's so many pieces of it.
Well, let me throw this at you. So Senator Rand Paul, he had a widely viewed YouTube video in which he basically put words that a lot of conservatives were thinking to what happened in this budget deal on Social Security. And he claimed that someone had swooped in the middle of the night and stolen from the old age part of Social Security to give to the disability part, like it was robbing Peter to pay Paul, pun intended. and is that what happened here?
That is obviously not what happened, but this is like, to misquote Mark Twain, by the time this lie had zoomed around 25 million viewers on Facebook, Truth was still looking for its shoes.
Tying its shoes, I think, if we're going to do justice to Mr. Twain.
Well, in my misquoting of him, It's faster now. In Twain's days, truth was already tying
Racing
his shoes. But today, they're still looking for
in
him.
In the internet age, you can even already found the shoes.
The lie is Fair. To 25 million people. It's really insidious, though, and it is, you know, it's abhorrent that somebody who is an elected official would actually knowingly lie for his paymasters on Wall Street.
Of course, this wasn't the first time that Rand Paul has lied about the disability insurance program.
Right.
He likes to claim that it's benefiting people who are just a little bit anxious or maybe have some back pain. We've had whole episodes devoted to Rand Paul and his claims. Yep. But what you're saying is that this was not that.
He's a liar.
Let's just get that out of the way.
He's a liar. He lies for his paymasters on Wall Street. One of the things that he does is they try to convince people that they're going to get nothing so that they accept less than they're owed. That's the main tactic. So in this case, the fact is he doesn't want all Americans to know that every working American, almost every single working American, is covered by both disability and life insurance as part of the one Social Security system that exists. That you and I and everyone who has that, who sees the FICA withholding on their paycheck, has $1.7 million in life and disability insurance. That this is one wage insurance system. He wants to divide and conquer. It is the oldest strategy of all tyrants, which is what the greedy liars on Wall Street are. And they want to point two parts. They want to divide the people and say, seniors, you're against people with disabilities, or younger folks, you're against seniors, or any division they can find, they exploit it so that people can't understand the power that we have when we stand together.
Tracy,
so,
next time that we have Alex on, I want it to be a drinking game.
Oh,
and I
yes.
think it's one drink for paymasters, two drinks for tyrants, and three drinks for liars on Wall Street.
Greedy liars on Wall Street. So as someone who was not involved in this political fight like the two of you were, can you break it down for me? How then were we able to push back against these messages? Because it sounds like talking to the two of you, that we were somewhat surprised that we got this victory, non-victory outcome. So what was the political calculus that happened?
Well, I have a theory, and Alex, tell me if you agree with this. Americans love Social Security. They really freaking love it, and they hate the idea of benefit cuts. And they are across income levels, across party lines, across generations, really, really strongly opposed to cutting benefits. And disability insurance is a core part of that Social Security system, as Alex said. And so the American people were not going to let it happen.
And they're just not going to let the Rand Pauls of the world scare them off?
I think that's totally right, because the American people understand that a benefit cut is just somebody reaching in their pocket and stealing their money. And no one likes that. Republican, Democrat, Independent, Tea Party, union-led household, 80% of Americans agree they love Social Security. What I think is important that you left out there is your own work, is the work of the organized progressive voices that built power over the last 6 years, from 2010, when there was a turn towards austerity, to today, just consistently organizing people and stitching together constituent groups, you know, labor with the Progressive Net Roots, with women's organizations, with a host of other organizations.
And the disability community.
The disability community, until we had built a true army of people standing shoulder to shoulder and saying, look, you can try, but we will not go down easy. And that was the calculus that got us to the budget deal.
So it was not a victory, but still something we should celebrate, because millions of people were protected from needless benefit cuts that actually looked like they might really happen because Republicans had their minds set.
And one more thing. It's also a full demonstration of the power that we have when we stand together. When we stand together shoulder to shoulder and say, this is our line in the sand. Come at us if you want, but we're going to win. And they knew that. And that's why they did not actually tried to go after what we know they wanted because they knew that we would beat them when we stand together. That's a lesson that I think, that's why I said not a victory, but an opportunity, because it shows us what we can do on offense as well. Because now standing shoulder to shoulder, we should start walking forward. We should start demanding an increase to benefits, expanding benefits, dealing with the fact that next year 70 million Americans will not receive a COLA.
Well, that's a good segue, actually. So, Tracy, what's our...
It's almost like you knew where we wanted to go with this opening, Alex.
I know. And what's our number of the week? Despite the fact that I gave a large hint at the beginning of the show, our number of the week is 3.9, Alex. Do you know why that is?
Two reasons. One, it is the average increase in CEO pay in America.
That is correct.
Which is why senior senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, chose that number to give as the raise that 70 million people who receive benefits calculated with a CPI would receive. See, that was way
ding,
too
ding,
complicated.
Ding, ding, ding.
Let's translate for a second.
Yes.
So you mentioned COLA and you mentioned CPI. We've got a lot of acronyms here, many of which start with C. Social Security benefits year over year increase to account for rising cost of living. Right. And that cost of living adjustment is what ends up getting called a COLA. We're not talking about Coca-Cola. We are talking about the Social Security COLA.
And what it does is just maintains the benefit. Right. It's not an increase. It's to maintain the purchasing power of the benefits so that benefits do not erode over time.
And that COLA is based on the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which is like a basket of goods that gets looked at. And tell me if I'm getting this right, because I might be making this
one
up.
You know you are.
But what gets considered as that measure of inflation is calculated each year includes a lot of things, but the cost of gas, fuel prices, actually has a lot to do with it.
Right.
Right? So there are questions that have been raised about whether the CPI is an accurate measure of inflation for people like seniors who might not be spending as much of their income on fuel, but who maybe spend more of it on health care and food and housing and such.
I know that we don't have that much time to dive into CPI and everything. I'd like to sum it up as with one thing. That's not the discussion. I mean, we need to have that discussion, but this is a complete anomaly this year. How much people spend on gas is one thing, but when gas prices fall by 50%, that is going to, on average, erase all the other cost increases of a basket of goods, right? So this is a very anomalous year. So we should have an adjustment made to the CPI or what's used to measure the COLA. But I think this year as well is a unique, specific case where it makes sense that Elizabeth Warren puts forward a bill that gives a one-time $580 check to the 70 million Americans who will not receive a COLA increase next year because their costs are going up. I mean, just ask any single person on a fixed income if their costs are going up, and you will hear 100% of the time, yes.
And this is what, the second time, the third time in the history of cost of living adjustments that there hasn't been an increase in Social Security?
And all of them are due to extremely huge macroeconomic issues, right? And they are not reflective of the costs that seniors, people with disabilities, veterans are actually facing. For example, the cost of butter has gone up, right? That's true. The cost of milk has gone up. And for seniors and people with disabilities especially, the cost of healthcare has increased faster than the rate of inflation, as it does every single year. It's the greedy liars on Wall Street again.
So you both described, obviously, the popularity of Social Security and this grand coalition we have of various, I guess, for lack of a better word, interest groups that have put their own leverage and power behind protecting and hopefully expanding Social Security. But given the fact that this is more or less a do-nothing Congress, what are the chances of this legislation? What are you hearing right now?
Here's what I'm hearing. It's mainly me talking to myself, though.
Isn't that why you started a radio station?
Yeah, exactly. I listen to myself. Here it is. 70 million people will receive a letter in December that says you will receive no increase in your benefits next year. 70 million people, seniors, veterans, people with disabilities. This is an election year. When that letter goes out, every switchboard on Capitol Hill is going to light up. And every office is going to be scrambling for a way to appease the American people who are outraged. And wouldn't you know it, Senator Warren will have a bill sitting there that says, here's what we do. We send a $580 check, a one-time payment.
Equivalent to 3.9% of the average Social Security benefit.
Exactly.
Not by coincidence.
If it's good enough for CEOs, it's good enough for seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. A one-time payment of $580 during an election year to 70 million people. I think that's math that even the Republicans can understand.
Particularly interesting timing as well, given the presidential cycle that we're in and the conversation about what do we do with Social Security?
Exactly.
And if it wasn't clear enough that Alex and Rebecca are in love with Social Security.
And each other.
We were at a bar a couple weeks ago and they were discussing what kind of Social Security tattoos they want to get. So just had to out you guys there.
That's true. That is
true. I told you what I was going to get, right?
Yeah.
Hazards and vicissitudes.
And wah, on that wah. Note, we want to thank Alex Lawson from We Act Radio and Social Security Works. We've got a full episode ahead because I was out in California again, so I brought back a great interview with a mentor. That's all I do is any excuse to go to California.
I've noticed that as your supervisor.
And that's why Rebecca's the best supervisor. And we have The Weekly Worst is back, so this is a great show.
Yeah, we're very excited about it. And Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have you back soon.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross, and I'm currently in my hometown of Oakland, and this is a particularly special interview for me because I'm with Dr. Frida Kapoor Klein, who's an entrepreneur, activist, and partner at the Kapoor Center for Social Impact, but also a longtime mentor of mine. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's an incredible pleasure to see you, to watch your career, to see how you've made such a huge impact in the world.
And I can't thank you enough because I think I might have mentioned you on a previous show, but Frida was one of the founders of the scholarship that put me through college. And so not only has she invested in many students of color like myself in the past, she's doing a lot of work around the Bay Area. And so we're talking today, I guess, a lot about the work that you're doing at the Kapoor Center. And the mission of the Kapoor Center is to leverage information technology for social impact. Can you describe a bit about what the work of the center does broadly?
Well, the Kapoor Center, which is our community engagement and philanthropic arm of what we do, really is looking at the intersection of racial justice, social justice, and tech. So in the community engagement and philanthropy side of things, it's how can we give early support as we did to Oakland-based groups like Black Girls Code and the Hidden Genius Project. It's also what kinds of convenings can we do? How can we bring communities together? So we've been talking to community groups, and we've been talking to the chief diversity officer at Uber about what does it mean that Uber bought a very big building here in Oakland and is going to move between 2,000 and 3,000 employees will be working in Oakland. How can we get ready for that? How can we prepare Oakland residents for those jobs at Uber? Or then something like the College Bound Brotherhood, which Cedric Brown and I started together many years ago to keep young African-American men on a college-bound path. So now we're talking to the College-Bound Brotherhood groups about how do you make sure that tech is something front and center as they're thinking about college, as they're thinking about careers. How do you begin to help communities of color understand that tech is going to change every job?
And so This summer, you and your husband, Mitch Kapor, made an announcement at the White House that you were going to be investing approximately $40 million in diversifying Silicon Valley. And something that Mitch said that I really loved was, genius is evenly distributed across zip codes, access and opportunity or not. And I love that because given the work that I do, I talk a lot about how your zip code impacts your life outcomes. So what is the scope of the problem of the tech opportunity gap in Silicon Valley?
The gap is just huge and it's inexcusable. And to give an example, one of the things that we've been doing over the past several years is running weekend hackathons for middle school and high school kids from low-income communities of color. And they come for a weekend and their assignment is to build an app that solves a real problem in their schools or communities. And what they build is unbelievably inspiring, and often it's very poignant and heartbreaking. So, for instance, one of the apps that one of the groups built at an Oakland hackathon was about how to layer GPS data and real-time crime data together so that they could walk home from school safely. And if you've never thought about that, if you were a kid who got to solve calculus problems in your head walking home from school, you have no idea what that gap translates into and what accidents of birth, if you're born privileged, puts you on a track to go many places, including into tech. And if you're born into poverty, even though you're only 20 miles from the global headquarters of Google or Facebook, you don't know one person that works in those companies.
And so with this investment that you guys are doing to address this gap, you put out a statement saying that you were going to work on three interrelated areas for a comprehensive approach. They're access to tech education, access to capital, and strong community institutions. So I want to walk through the all three of these. So what are you doing with regard to access to tech education?
So the Level Playing Field Institute, which you, Tracy, know well because the Ideal Scholars Program, of which you are a Star alum. The Ideal Scholars Program was a program of the Level Playing Field Institute. For the past 12 years, we've been running the SMASH Academy, Summer Math and Science Honors Academy, for low-income high school kids of color. The program's always been half girls. And scholars come all three summers of high school. They live in a dorm on a college campus, and they study math and science and computer science and engineering design. There's also a social justice curriculum. There's public speaking. There's college counseling. There's SAT prep. So across the three summers, they're with us for 15 weeks. And what we try to do is change their trajectory, give them a sense and of new opportunities, give them access, and to make them more competitive with their more privileged counterparts. So part of our pledge is giving $2 million a year for each of 3 years, so that's a total of $6 million, to expand the SMASH Academy. So this summer, 2016, we will be opening a new program at UC Davis, and UC Davis is on its way to becoming a Hispanic-serving institution. We're hoping to open a Pathways program in 2016 for a full program at Morehouse, which will be our first foray outside of California and an HBCU. So those are examples, but the SMASH Academy, we're trying to expand it nationally, as well as develop a full-blown alumni program where we have summer internships for our SMASH alumni who are now in college, internships into tech.
So that leads into my next question. What sorts of outcomes have you seen from some of the SMASH alums so far?
Well, we've got SMASH alumni, so they come to us at age 14. So it takes them a few years to get through high school and then get through college. But we have, for instance, we've got 23 current SMASH alumni who are now undergraduates at your alma mater at Berkeley. We've got undergraduates at many at Morehouse and MIT and Middlebury, just for the M schools, and all across the country. And they're doing amazing things, and they are persisting in STEM. We just actually hired a SMASH alumni to be the communications manager at Level Playing Field Institute. So they're working in all kinds of tech companies as interns and once they come out of college. Many of them are also pursuing graduate school. So we think that's just an incredibly rich resource of great diverse talent.
And the second pillar of work that you are investing is access to capital. Can you explain a little bit why this is significant, what the problem looks like, and what you're planning on doing?
Well, so we invest in seed stage tech startups with social impact through KPOR Capital, which is our investing arm. The majority of people on the investment team are people of color, and we are right now at about a 50% mark for our entrepreneurs, our founders being underrepresented. And in tech, that means women from all backgrounds, as well as African American and Latino men. And what we find and what we passionately believed is that lived experience matters, and that different founders of color, bring a different lens to the kinds of companies they're founding. So just like the story about the kids in the hackathon bring a whole different perspective and what they develop an app to solve, in the same way, the grown-ups from those backgrounds bring a different lived experience. So we've got some absolutely amazing gap-closing companies. So, for instance, we've got one company that's been written about in a few places called Pigeonly, and Frederick Hudson is the founder and CEO, and they're doing amazingly well. And they are providing services for the incarcerated and their families, and moving into services for the formerly incarcerated. So their first product was to radically reduce the cost of phone calls to and from prison. That's important on many, many levels. Increasingly, prisons are removed farther and farther away, and yet we know recidivism data strongly correlates to how many and how close the ties are that someone who's incarcerated, how close their ties they maintain with family and community. So if you move prisons farther and farther away, they're more dependent on things like phone calls. Phone calls in and out of prison are still $3 or $4 a minute. And I mean, that ought to be the crime. But Pigeonly has reduced that cost by a factor of 10. They also help families get photos in and out of you know, prisoners want to see their children grow up, and they're missing all of those important moments. And so they want to see pictures of their sons and daughters at big events, at school celebrations, at soccer games. And there's a particular form factor that photos have to be in to get inside and out of prison. So being able to send from your phone to Pigeonly those photos and have Pigeonly put them in the right form and get them to the prisoners makes a huge difference. We have a company in upstate New York, Plaza Familia, built by Ana Roca Castro, who was an immigrant from the Dominican Republic. And she was a math whiz, but because she didn't speak English, they put her in remedial math. And she wants to make sure that kids don't have the experience that she had. So she's got a fully bilingual, in many languages, platform that parents and teachers and students can use for many subjects. And it's focused on Title I schools. So it's not something that only rich parents can buy. It is something that parents have access to for free. And it's paid for by buckets of money that have already been allocated and go unspent. So those are just a couple of examples of the kinds of companies that KPOR Capital funds. Just a couple of days ago here in Oakland, we funded the we supported the first ever pitch competition, along with Google for Entrepreneurs and Village Capital, that where the startups were tech startups using that technology to somehow lessen bias, mitigate it in various forms of employment. So it was things like, how do employers find diverse talent that they're now currently missing? How do you change your job descriptions to make them more appealing to a broader set of candidates? How do you look to change the language in performance reviews, for instance? How do you conduct interviews in a way that is almost like a blind orchestra audition, so that you don't see the race or the gender or the age or the school of the applicant who's applying for a programming job? All you see is their programming skills. And then you find out that they're a Latina, or that they're an African-American man, or that they're a veteran, or that they're older, or that they're younger. But they've already demonstrated that they can code, and you need coders.
That's something that's particularly interesting, because I know a fairly common criticism of Silicon Valley and the tech sector across the nation is so-called pattern matching, and which is essentially looking at a profile of what you think a successful tech worker would be. And it's often, I guess, replicating the current average white male coworker going to Ivy League schools, that sort of thing. So do you think that the tech sector broadly, I feel like you're working from a very social justice oriented position. Do you think the tech sector broadly is starting to understand that practices such as pattern matching aren't great? Because I've heard a lot of people saying, well, you know, we have a meritocracy and people are just getting through and we're just using, you know, reasonable criteria, when really it's just churning out the same kind of applicants.
I think there's been a groundswell of attention to diversity issues in tech in the last couple of years, and it is long overdue. I think many, many people and all of the rigorous research challenges the notion that Silicon Valley, or tech more broadly, is a meritocracy. It just flatly isn't. So what we have is employee referrals. And so we have what researchers call in-group advantage. You don't necessarily have to be biased against somebody. You can be biased in favor of somebody, and that gets you pattern matching, and that gets you a very unlevel playing field. So I think exposing the mythology of meritocracy in tech has been a really important undertaking. And now it's helping tech figure out how to do it differently. And that's why the startups themselves, the tech tools that can be used to mitigate bias, are really so important. What tech has done is it has confused credentials for skills. And what we're trying to do is to separate those and to help people find skills and talent wherever they exist, and not use credentials as a proxy for talent. Because if you only use credentials, it will be completely biased, and it will be biased towards the status quo, towards the already privileged.
So the last kind of major bucket of work that you're investing in is this, I guess, community institutions, creating strong community institutions. Can you describe a little bit about that?
So sure, some of those community groups are things like some that I already mentioned. So we were amongst the first funders of Black Girls Code. We were amongst the first funders of the Hidden Genius Project and other institutions. So for instance, for the last few years, many places in the country have been doing an hour of code, and President Obama last year actually learned to write some code, and that was a very cool moment for the country and for tech in particular. So for instance, what we've been doing the last few years for the Hour of Code for that week is to host a Brothers Code event for middle school and high school boys of color. And we bring in engineers, Latino, African-American engineers from all the big local tech companies. you know, an African-American engineer from Uber, a Latino from Twitter, from LinkedIn, from Google, from Facebook, and have these men as role models, as mentors at the Brothers Code kinds of events. And it's amazingly moving. And what's been so fascinating and painful is for all of the adult men to say to us personally afterwards, to thank us and to talk about how meaningful the event was for them and how much they wish they had had something like this when they were coming up. And so it's another reminder of how different the worlds we live in and how unevenly distributed the access and the opportunities are.
And despite, I think, the fact that you just named a lot of really important ways that technology can help communities, I think in the Bay Area, a lot of communities of color and low-income communities are feeling a bit wary of the tech sector because it's associated with a lot of new people moving in and driving up rents. And so there's, I think, a bit of hesitation around us, I guess, kind of hanging our hat on the tech sector is helping to lift up Oakland in particular, you know, or lift up the Bay Area broadly. How are you, I guess, building in this concern into the work that you do? Obviously, your job is not to build more affordable housing, but how does that play into the work that you're doing?
Well, we moved to Oakland from San Francisco a few years ago because Mitch, who many people have described as someone who sees around corners. About 4 years ago, Mitch said, Oakland is going to become the next tech hub. Let's move there. Let's help make it happen. And let's try to influence it to happen. Tech done right is how we often think about it. So we're trying to bring the right players together. And there are many amazingly great things about Oakland. And the mayor, Libby Schaff, has been quite open. She has somebody on her staff who's worked, Jose Corona, who's working on strategic partnerships. And there are real conversations happening here. So, for instance, the conversation we were having about Uber moving here is how to get the Oakland community access to those jobs. We're talking to developers about building affordable housing. We're talking about building campuses for tech startups that include classrooms so that right in those buildings, there will be classrooms that community children can come, hang out after school, do their homework, learn to code, and see people who look like them starting and building successful tech companies. So I think it's many different stages of intervention. It's many thoughtful discussions. We see ourselves as conveners, and we have our own building opening in Oakland in the first half of 2016. And we're hoping that that will really be a community center for these kinds of conversations to happen and for these worlds that have been too distant from each other, for these worlds to meet and to talk and, most importantly, to collaborate.
Before I let you go, in that vein, what are you hoping that tech companies that are coming into Oakland understand about this city and what it means to truly partner with the communities around them? Because I hope that they are putting in these classrooms and these sorts of things, but I'm sure that, you know, that a philosophy, their company philosophy will be important too. So what are you hoping that the next, I guess, Uber that sets its sights on Oakland considers?
Well, I hope that people are coming to Oakland for what Oakland offers, not just leaving San Francisco because it's become unaffordable. So that there are both push and pull reasons for tech to come to Oakland. We are hoping that Oakland becomes the tech hub for impact companies, and that people will come here because they can find a vibrancy of community and a vibrancy of talent that cares about fairness, that also has a long history of political activity, that has a long history of arts and cultural involvement, and that the tech companies that see that as an asset will be the ones that come here and figure out how to leverage that asset to build even more creative and more interesting kinds of tech companies.
Frida Kapor Klein, entrepreneur, activist, and partner at the Kapor Center for Social Impact. Thank you so much for joining me.
A true pleasure, and congratulations on everything you're doing in the world, Tracy.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. On this episode, we're talking a bit about the digital divide. I'm joined by John Horrigan, a senior researcher focusing on the internet and technology at Pew Research Center. He's also the author of the report, Narrowing Gaps, New Challenges, Adoption of Information and Communications Technologies in the United States. Thanks for joining.
My pleasure to be with you.
So the term digital divide was coined about 30 years ago, but back then only about 14% of people described themselves as internet users. So today, about 85% of people describe themselves as internet users. So can we still argue that there's a digital divide?
Well, I think in the minds of a lot of people, certainly it is still a valid notion. And part of the story here is that even as the gaps get smaller, a lot of people think the consequences of being disconnected get greater. For instance, we at the Pew Research Center have done some surveys on whether people think it's a major disadvantage to not have a broadband internet connection at home. And when we asked that question in 2010, just under 50% of people said that to not have broadband was a major disadvantage across a number of different areas. We asked about, like, getting news about your community, healthcare information, information about government. That number grew substantially in our latest survey in 2015 to 65% of people saying that not having broadband was a major disadvantage. So as so many things in our lives are mediated by the internet, not having access becomes more consequential for people, which is why people continue to talk about a digital divide.
And so you mentioned broadband, and I know that through research that you all have done, you've seen that access to the internet through mobile devices is actually pretty consistent across demographics. Why is there, a significance about still having broadband access if so many people are able to access the internet through different ways?
The smartphone certainly has helped to close the digital divide, because we see a rise in the incidence of people saying they are smartphone only, which is to say they don't have a broadband connection at home, yet they have a smartphone as their primary or sole means to get online. So the smartphone is wonderful tool for closing the digital divide. But when we ask people who are smartphone reliant about how they use the internet, we find that they're more subject to things like data caps or overcharges that go along with having data caps, or they're more likely to have to disconnect their service due to financial constraints than people who have a smartphone but also broadband at home. All that is to say is that as nifty as smartphones are for accessing the internet, the small screen, the presence of data caps, it does place some constraints on people's internet usage patterns, and those constraints are largely not present with broadband internet connections, which is why a lot of focus remains on the broadband element.
So I imagine also you talked about the homework gap in a piece you wrote. So I imagine there's certain things like applying for jobs or being able to do homework that makes having limited access to broadband particularly complicated for low-income households and people of color.
That's exactly right. The broadband connection is still, for the most part, more capacious pipe for getting data into your house. And that, with the larger screens that people have with broadband internet connections, either with tablet computers or laptops, means that using the internet for things like job search or for homework is just easier to do when you have that broadband connection and only have to use the smaller screen smartphone.
Something that I found interesting that you also wrote about was that you said that an emerging challenge is digital readiness. So not necessarily the digital divide so much, but the capacity for online and offline populations to improve their skill levels and knowledge base for next generation applications. Can you explain what digital readiness means?
Sure. And the work I've done on digital readiness actually predates my time at the Pew Research Center, but it is based on work I did that involved a national survey of adults. And in that work, I found that about a third of the general population, and this includes people who have internet access and don't have internet access, have low levels of digital readiness, which is to say they lack the skills to really do the things online at the depth that society often expects them to in terms of negotiating financial transactions, looking for healthcare information, doing online learning, and that sort of thing. So in that context, an issue to look at is not just whether people have technology or don't, but whether people have the skills and the trust in technology to really get all the things out of using the internet that increasingly government and financial institutions and healthcare providers expect these days.
So what is the root cause of that? Is it the lack of having broadband in your household that allows you to, I guess, grow these skills over time, or is it a gap in education in our schools?
Some of it's education, some of it's age. Older adults tend to have lower levels of digital skills than younger adults, but I should add that digital skills can be an issue at all age levels. So it's essentially the capacity to keep up with so much of the new that comes down the road these days when it comes to technology. So once people have mastered how to set up a wireless network and their Wi-Fi connection and get everything working at home for basic internet access, then new innovations come at people, such as smart homes or personalized healthcare applications and that sort of thing. And so people need guideposts on how to use these new technologies, and some people get up to speed rather quickly, and others need a little bit of help.
John Horrigan, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And it's the weekly worst, which we have not done in a super long time. Tracy, remind us, because I actually have forgotten, and I'm sure our listeners have forgotten, how the hell we do the weekly worst.
So, this episode of The Weekly Worst, it's just like every other one, I suppose, where we
I thought there were about to be special rules. I was going to write them down.
I was going to pretend like something special was happening. Each week,
Jesus-ish,
we have Alan Pike from Think Progress come in with...
Who's nothing special.
Who is very special. He's dressed snazzy today for the return of The Weekly Worst.
Just for you, radio listeners.
Got three awful stories related to poverty, and we get to vote on which one is the worst.
And sometimes he doles out four bags of cow shit, but that's a really special occasion when that happens, and usually reserved for Speaker Paul Ryan. So, Alan, in your snazzy outfit made for radio, tell us what's the first of the Weekly Worst nominees.
I'm glad you remember my name, since you don't remember how the segment works, at least.
I was going to make a joke about that, and I thought better of it because I thought it would hurt your feelings.
All right. Well, I'm pretty tough. on the outside.
What's the story?
Kmart. Kmart is the story. Kmart is staying open on Thanksgiving, and workers are saying the company hasn't even let them know who's scheduled for the holiday yet. So the store's workers are in kind of a holiday planning limbo. The company is planning to keep its doors open from 6 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day through 10 p.m. the following day, Black Friday, but 95% of workers surveyed still don't know their own holiday schedules.
Man.
That's according to coworker.org.
Well, one of the big stories is that Kmart still exists. I did not know that.
Sick burn. Sick retail burn.
But since they do, they obviously need to be treating their workers well. And I know, I feel like I'm not trying
We're
to disrespect
the workers.
We're
going to get so much Twitter hate out of this one.
I'm not disrespecting the workers. I just didn't know Kmart still existed.
Yeah. Well.
Well, and the for a couple of examples of how this limbo is screwing with people's lives, my colleague Bryce Covert interviewed a couple of workers, one named Nick, who said, if I can't use those tickets to go down there, my family's just wasted $600, and I don't think Kmart's going to give me an extra $600 to give back to my family.
And we're talking about low-wage workers here. This is not people necessarily working in a she office environment who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars. These are people who are largely living paycheck to paycheck, who don't have paid leave or paid sick days or any other basic workplace protections, but they also, in addition to the incredibly low wages, are facing this not just around the holidays when it is most upsetting and heartbreaking, but also they often don't know their schedules in advance generally, right? And that's a growing trend with low-wage work. But this, you know, especially around the holidays, is really, really sad.
And yeah. This is something where, you know, we have debates about different job quality policies. Mm-hmm. We debate minimum wage. We debate access to health care, to paid leave, all of these different things. This is a no-cost solution. It's something easy. If we have predictive scheduling, this is something that will be extremely beneficial for workers, for families, and it won't cost employers anything. It often actually is more valuable for employers to have predictive scheduling.
Yeah. I think the way they think about it is that it's maximizing and exploiting, of course, but maximizing the productivity of their workforce by basically treating them like cogs in the wheel, because they can say, oh, I'm going to put you wherever is most efficient for me and, you know, whatever based on when I think the most customers are going to be there and so forth.
Right.
But as you point out, what it does is it erodes morale and it creates all sorts of turnover, which have other costs that they're not thinking
about.
Exactly.
And that stuff all trickles. That all rolls downhill from the boardroom, where the obsession over quarterly reports and what are we going to tell the shareholders and stuff, that breeds a mentality about labor where instead of viewing workers as a resource and an investment in delivering products and services to your customers, you treat them as a cost to be squeezed as tightly as possible. And so we've been doing a lot of coverage every Thanksgiving season of the various brands that are either doing sort of senseless things or sensible things around Thanksgiving. And Bryce, my colleague, has been all over that stuff. And I encourage people to go to the site and check it out, because there are a number of stores that have announced that they're going to close for Thanksgiving. There are a couple of others that have said they're going to stay open, but we're not exactly sure when. And then there's REI, which actually decided to close on Black Friday, which is
kudos.
The biggest day for retail stores. They're just shutting up shop entirely and encouraging people to get outside instead.
And of course, that website is thinkprogress.org. Shameless
O-R-G.
Plug.
There you go. So what's your second story?
All right. So this one's a little complicated, but HUD is banning smoking in public housing nationwide, just as the Senate prepares to undermine the nation's public housing system by allowing 300 local housing authorities to start tinkering with eligibility rules and evictions policies however they see fit. So while the smoking ban could lead to some evictions, housing advocates that I talk to are mostly on board with it on the grounds that secondhand smoke is undeniably dangerous, even for non-smokers who live all the way down the hall from somebody who smokes in the same building. Instead of fighting the ban, these advocates are concerned about a Senate bill and the HUD budget that's coming out of the Senate, which would expand a pilot program that's been going for 20 years. So a pilot program that's somehow 19 years old, sort of weird. But this is a program that allows local housing authorities to tinker with federal rules about eligibility, they can do things like link people's eligibility for public housing to their child's report card. It's one of those sort of let's tinker around, see what works ideas, except none of them are required to keep track of outcomes and report back findings. So we've been doing this for 20 years. We have no idea what works and what doesn't. And the Senate, or at least some people in the Senate, want to expand it dramatically from like 34 housing authorities to 334. So it struck me as interesting that at the same time that we're banning smoking in public housing, there's this other sort of darker thing happening in the background.
Well, and of course, I mean, folks who would like to expand that, right, what they're really after, and let's just call a spade, is arming these local public housing authorities with as many opportunities as they possibly can have to evict people, to deny them housing. I mean, that's really what this is about. It's very similar to state trends of like drug testing of public assistance applicants. And of course, we've seen a trend over the years of something called LearnFair, which is linking public assistance to kids' grades, right? Really, really stuff that we need to keep an eye on. And the smoking ban, I feel like it's complicated for all the reasons you said, right? We all care about public health. We all care about the effects of secondhand smoke on particularly kids, but on all sorts of tenants who should have the opportunity to live in a safe and healthy environment. But at the same time, if the way they enforce that ban is by evicting people from public housing that they're often waiting years and years to be able to access and they end up being homeless, it's just adding to the challenges that people face to have, you know, safe and stable housing for them and their families.
And not to mention the fact that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in public housing to make sure that people aren't having asthma due to mold, that there's a number of things that I think are more pressing than, I guess, regulating people's vices. You know, we allow wealthier people to have vices in our society, but we expect low-income people to be perfect. And again, you know, you can understand this is government-controlled property, so maybe there's a public health opportunity. But as I was saying, you know, we saw even just with Hurricane Sandy, public housing was in poor shape. There were elevator outages. There's so many things that need to be done in public housing before we get to smoking, which I still don't really think should be regulated in this way.
And let's focus on the slumlords and the landlords as opposed to just the tenants.
Exactly, exactly. All right, so what's the third
All right.
Story.
Third up is a pair of contracting firms used by Silicon Valley giants like Apple and eBay have been committing chronic wage theft and are being banned from hiring immigrants who enter the country on high-skill H-1B visas. Those visas are supposed to require that workers get paid the prevailing local wage for whatever type of work they're performing. But these two companies were instead paying their H-1B workers as though they were entry-level employees. That was costing the workers themselves about $1,000 a month each.
Oh,
and now it's cost companies like Apple and eBay one source of relatively cheap contract labor. Illegally cheap contract labor, as it turns out.
I'm sorry. Are immigrants humans? I lost track there.
Who are you asking?
I mean,
me?
I was gonna say based on that
I was
story,
asking the straw man.
Saying,
I was asking the straw man, Alan, the one behind you.
it's a weird kind of wage theft because most of the time, wage theft that you hear about takes a more sort of brute force kind of form. People manipulating time cards, people not paying minimum wage, people saying, "Okay, just clock out and then come back to the warehouse. I got another half hour work for you." And this is sort of subtler. This is a couple of middlemen companies that furnish high skill contractors to tech firms, skimming off, you know, a grand a month per head from the system.
It's got real parallels to the subminimum wage, which we legally can pay to people with disabilities in certain types of workplaces, as we've talked about on past shows. But we are getting the rotating finger from our producer, Alyssa, who is looking very angry that we are taking so long to discuss all of these horrible stories. Does that mean we have to vote?
I think it's time to vote. So we have what
Kmart,
were the stories again? Kmart,
HUD and public housing. And
exploiting immigrant
labor in Silicon Valley.
All bad as usual, although not quite as horrifying as the blood one from the last weekly worst. I have to vote for Kmart. It's so freaking heartless, right?
Yeah.
These parents don't know if they're going to be able to be with their kids and their families for the holidays, and many of them won't be able to, and they can't plan. I'm sorry. That's horrible. I'm voting for Kmart.
I'm voting with you just for many of the reasons you pointed out earlier, that this is something that happens year-round, too. So this is a big issue that we talk a lot in our work. So Kmart's my vote, too.
Yeah, it's unanimous.
Wow. This happens so rarely.
We're the weekly
best. The Kmart
best.
Thing's terrible. It's And it's the same, honestly, it's the same kind of philosophy as at work in the HUD story that we talked about, where instead of, these are systems where people in charge are looking to squeeze, to sort of wrench every last drop of value out of a washcloth, that when really that's addressing the wrong problem. These are systems where if you invest the kind of time and money and resources into people at that lower level or frontline level of any system that you're talking about, whether it's anti-poverty work or actual, you know, employment, you're going to get the returns you get from that over time far exceed the short-term value that you can wring out of it.
So you heard it here first. Kmart is still in business and they're treating their employees poorly.
So they get the Black Heart special?
There you go. All right. I think that's all the time we have. Alan Pike from Think Progress, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure as always.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can listen on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. Don't forget to rate us and leave us a review, and we'll be sure to shout out some of our loyal listeners on the air. You can also feel free to pitch us on some segment ideas via Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or by emailing us at info@talkpoverty.org.
We'll see you next week.